To celebrate the new year, New Letters on the Air dons the mask of January's namesake, the Roman god Janus. With one face looking forward and the other back at past programs, we hope to meet the approval of this patron of endings and beginnings by shedding some light on what inspires writers to write in the first place. We'll hear from Pulitzer Prize winners Tony Kushner, Jane Smiley, Richard Russo, and the late August Wilson, as well as from National Book Award winner Sherman Alexie and one of the chancellors of the Academy of American Poets, Naomi Shihab Nye.
I really think there are many imaginative ways that human beings could attempt to communicate, even ways that seem far-fetched.
Discover what sparks the imagination of these poets, novelists, and playwrights in the beginning, a special edition of New Letters on the Air, produced by New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam. We'll begin with Tony Kushner, who was born in New York City but raised in Louisiana by professional musicians who instilled in him a love of the arts and intellectual pursuits, encouraging him to memorize poems at an early age. From his first play in 1987, A Bright Room Called Day, to his screenplay for the 2012 movie Lincoln, Tony Kushner's work is suffused with history and political outrage. In 1992, he garnered worldwide attention with Angels in America, winning the Pulitzer Prize, a Tony, and the New York Drama Critics Circle Award for Best New Play. He wrote the screenplay for HBO, and the drama picked up a record number of Emmys. I asked Tony Kushner to talk about the genesis of this work that deals so openly with AIDS.
I originally wrote a poem called Angels in America just based on a dream that I had had, but it was in the middle of the early period of the epidemic in America in the mid-80s, and I was living actually in St. Louis, Missouri on an NEA directing fellowship for a year, and a friend of mine had gotten sick. I was starting to feel touched in a personal way by the epidemic because I began to know more and more people who were getting sick. And I had this dream. The only thing I remember was this angel crashing through the ceiling, and I wrote, I think, probably a terrible poem. I've never looked at it again. I don't think I've even reread it after I wrote it, but that was the beginning, and there were Mormons in it. I'm not even sure that they were in the dream, but they sort of popped into the poem, and I put it away. And then Oscar Eustace and the Eureka Theater commissioned me to write a play. After they had produced my first play, A Bright Room Called Day, I decided to go back to that image, which this was now 3 years later in 1987, and I went back to the image that I had had in my dream and thought about Mormons. Roy Cohn had just died, and then it started to turn into Angels in America, and the title was just the title of the poem.
Well, that explains why we couldn't find the poem.
Nobody will ever see it, I'm sure. I don't even know where it is now. I go and burn it.
That's interesting to me, too, that a play would come from an image the way it happens for poets. Poetry is so filled with images, and then it sounds like for you, some of the impulses for what you see on stage are the images.
Yeah, the only playwriting class I took was 3 or 4 weeks with Jean-Claude Vanatelli, who was the playwright in residence for Joe Chaykin's Open Theater. And they did America Hurrah together and other remarkable pieces in the late 60s and early 70s. And Jean-Claude had a playwriting exercise. It was based on a sort of famous old acting exercise. It was basically finding an image that he called the what of the play, the ground for the play, and the thing to which the writer would return over and over again to know that she or he was still sort of in touch with, I think, the core impulse or the core idea, and making it something that's imagistic as opposed to an idea or a verbal articulation of some sort, I think allows for a certain kind of freedom of invention, because the deeper meaning of the image is not something that one has necessarily consciously worked out, and it allows for more associative play and more free association. And I don't have an image for every single play that I do. Sometimes it's a title. The first play, A Bright Room Called Day, I went to an exhibit at Lincoln Center of the work of Agnes DeMille and heard across the room that she was working on a new piece at 80-something. And I thought she said that the piece was called A Bright Room Called Day. And I thought, oh, that's an incredibly beautiful title. And I went close to the video monitor and listened when the tape repeated itself. And it was actually a piece called A Bridegroom Called Death. And which I thought was not nearly as good a title as A Bright Room Called Day. And I, at that point, I knew that I wanted to write my first serious play, that I wanted to really sort of say, okay, I'm a playwright and I'm going to write a real play. And I didn't know what it was going to be about, but I suddenly knew that it was going to be called A Bright Room Called Day. And I thought it was sort of a Whitman-esque sort of Emily Dickinson. I mean, it sounded very American, which gave it an odd relationship to the subject that I eventually chose, which was the collapse of the constitutional democracy in the Weimar Republic in 1932 and 1933. But the image filled the play and was something that I bounced the darkness of the play off of for the entire time of writing it. And then sometimes there is a specific image, and even sometimes there's an idea. I mean, there's a specific thesis that you want to work out. It can come from a number of sources.
Playwright Tony Kushner, a 2012 National Medal of Arts recipient. In 1986, just a year before Kushner's first play, Richard Rousseau published his first novel, Mohawk. But it was his third novel, Nobody's Fool, that put him on the literary map, partly as a result of the successful movie with Paul Newman. Rousseau is considered a master craftsman and chronicler of his time, depicting the decline of small towns and his stomping grounds in the Northeast. The New York Times called him one of the best novelists around after his 2001 novel, Empire Falls, won the Pulitzer Prize. Though he often deals with hard luck folks, it's his ability to straddle comedy and despair that makes his writing resonate, a theme he explores in his hilarious novel, Straight Man. Richard Rousseau shares how the idea for that book began with an offhand comment by a colleague.
My first real academic job, or a tenure-track job, was at a place in Pennsylvania. I had been befriended there in my first year by a wonderful fellow and still a friend of mine, Kel Melling. He was an administrator. And we were walking along the campus, which had a duck pond right there, and the ducks were begging popcorn. We were walking through all the duck guano. Kel was bemoaning the fact that here it was August again. Classes were starting in just 2 or 3 weeks. His adjuncts were pounding on his door and calling him every day saying, am I going to get my section of freshman composition? Will I be paid? And he was saying, yet again, they're playing games. You know, the legislature won't give money to the university. The university won't give money to me. It's the same song and dance every year. Not that there's anything I can do about it. What am I going to do? Kill a duck a day till they give me my money? And, of course, the duck pond was wonderful, too, just in terms of its metaphorical value, because all the ducks, both in the real duck pond and in my fictional duck pond, were all fat. They were ducks that used to fly away during the off season, but now they've become so fat on student-fed popcorn that they can no longer migrate, which was, for me, a perfect metaphor for tenure.
Fiction writer Richard Rousseau. You're listening to In the Beginning, a special edition of New Letters on the Air as we explore what ignites a writer's imagination. Another novelist who's made fun of academic life in her book, Moo, Jane Smiley won her Pulitzer Prize for her novel, A Thousand Acres, which also won the National Book Critics Circle Award in 1991. Her modern retelling of King Lear is set on an Iowa farm, a part of the country she spent a lot of time in, first as a student at the Iowa Writers' Workshop and then as a teacher. Lately, I've been intrigued with what exactly is the impetus for a writer of a certain piece of work, if it's an idea or an image, or what is it that galvanizes a writer? For instance, when you set out to write The Thousand Acres, did you first envision this family, or did you start with the idea of King Lear?
No, I started with King Lear.
So it was an idea-based novel.
Right. I started with objections I had to interpretations of King Lear. But, you know, all those ideas just sort of wafted around in my mind for years until someone suggested, oh, you could set it on a farm. Actually, that person said you should set it on a farm in Kansas because we were looking at a picture on the wall in a McDonald's in Delhi, New York, of a wheat farm in Kansas. And I said, oh, I don't know anything about Kansas, and dismissed that idea. But then about 9 months later, I was driving down I-35 in northern Iowa, and I said, you know, this is where I should set it. And so that's what happened. And as soon as I said that, all of those ideas that had been wafting around in my mind just gelled into a lump. And I had an experience that other writers I've talked to have said they've had too, where it already exists. And your job now is just to do something with it, to describe it or to write through it or something like that. But the ideas have all come together in a sort of clump, and there you are.
And all you need to do is conjure it, basically.
Yes, Michael Chabon said that's what happened to him with The Adventures of Cavalier and Clay.
And Iowa is a place where you spent so much time.
Mm-hmm, 24 years.
I think people were probably expecting for you to set something in Iowa, but nothing probably on as grand and yet as small a scale as that, if that makes any sense.
Well, every novel is grand and small at the same time because it's particular. And yet, as soon as you begin talking about particulars, you start invoking universals. You just can't help yourself.
Novelist Jane Smiley, who returned to Iowa in her fiction and finished an epic trilogy in 2015 called The Last 100 Years. Consciously or not, good writers do invoke universal themes, even in very particular settings, such as an Indian reservation in Sherman Alexie's work. Born on a Spokane res in Washington State, Alexie planned to become a doctor before he stumbled into his first poetry workshop in college. He's since become one of the most popular poets and fiction writers of his generation, with many literary honors, including the National Book Award and a Sundance Filmmakers Trophy for his debut screenplay, Smoke Signals. But he's also interested in stories off the reservation.
Most of our literature fails to deal with urban Indian issues, even though 99% of publishing Native writers are urban. So part of it was for me was to start simply reflecting the reality of my life and of Indian life. I've lived urban for years. I've traveled the world now with my literary career. I've had dinner with the President of the United States. I've walked the Great Wall of China. I've swam in the Mediterranean Sea. And to somehow ignore that and ignore that amazing life is foolish. There's so much more material to be writing about. I'm sick of writing about my childhood. Trust me, I'm sick of it. I'm sure other people are sick of reading about it. You know, I've been moving out of strict autobiography and more into sort of imaginary places. In some ways, I'm still autobiographical in the sense that one of the impulses I have is to explore how my life would have been different if I would have made other choices. So it's still very, you know, narcissistic and vain. But now it's urban narcissistic and vain.
That's the joy, I think, of writing is that you get to live all these different lives in your imagination.
Yeah, I mean, I get to have great love affairs and you know.
Sleep with all these different women.
Yeah, and men. And, you know, and farm animals. So you can do anything inside the context of a story. So I get to have all sorts of adventures.
I wonder how you go about writing because your literature takes such interesting little turns that I just don't expect. Like the guy who picks up the hitchhiker and then they end up in the same hotel room together and this is out of the toughest Indian in the world. I mean, that just took so many little turns. I won't give it away for future readers, but when you're sitting down to write a story, do you just start at the beginning and go and then it just comes out?
Mostly, yes. I just write and the story happens. And sometimes in revision, you go back and plot lines change. But I like to be surprised. Writing for me is very improvisational. I sometimes get critically slammed because of it, because often the stories I publish are first or second drafts. Sometimes they're the 100th draft, but some stories aren't. And people can tell sometimes. Sometimes they're completely wrong. I love being surprised myself, and I love the initial surprise more than surprises down the road. And I know in reading stories, I love it when it's unpredictable. I love any art form when it's unpredictable, when people behave the way people really do. I mean, human beings are so contradictory and unpredictable and horrible and magical, and you never know. I mean, I'm married. I've been married for, you know, years, and she's a total stranger to me. Who the hell are you sometimes? And I love it when that feeling exists in art as well. I think that's the great wonderment of writing, is asking those questions. Gosh, I mean, I wish I had answers. I have none. I just hope I ask really cool questions.
But you're dealing so much with some serious issues about being Indian in a predominantly white world. You know, sometimes there's some real anger there. Do you think that's part of what drives your writing?
I think every writer's angry. I think anger is a powerful motivating force. who was it? Toni Morrison, I think, who said, "I'm just writing out of revenge." So
I think a lot of writers have said that too. Yeah.
So no, I think it's very much a motivating factor in my work. It's easy to stereotype me as the angry Indian, the hostile, which I've heard me described as without irony, right? The hostile, as if Indians haven't been called that for a long time. So I have all sorts of diverse, complicated political and philosophical and social thoughts, some which you could classify as Indian-centric, others as American-centric. I'm angry about a lot of things that aren't just Indian issues. I think it's a good thing.
National Book Award winner Sherman Alexie, who won a Pushcart Prize for his poem Avian Nights that was first published in New Letters magazine. You're listening to In the Beginning, a special edition of New Letters on the Air about what fuels writers' fires. For Arab American poet and fiction writer Naomi Shihab Nye, the joy of personal stories and relationships often spark her to write, as with this poem about her Palestinian father who adopted his American wife's country to raise his family.
He sang with abandon, combing his black, black hair. Each morning in the shower, first in Arabic, rivery ripples of song carrying him back to his first beloved land, then in English, where his repertoire was short. "No kind at all," we'd shout, throwing ourselves into the brisk arc of his cologne for a morning kiss. But he gave us freedom to be fools if we needed to, which we certainly would later, which we all do now and then. Perhaps a father's greatest gift, that blessing.
That's such a wonderful piece.
Thank you. My brother and I could never understand, you know, why we had to hear that song every single morning. But there was something humorous about it, you know, and I'm sure he still sings it today in the shower. But if you have somebody always singing, "What kind of fool am I?" it sort of makes you feel more comfortable in your own foolishness when it comes up, as it always does.
You write so much about your family in your books. There's probably a poem for everyone in your family, but there's a really nice one about your brother, because you two are very different people, I gather, from reading this poem.
The little brother poem?
It must be that one.
Yeah. It was written a long time ago after my brother had moved away. And he and I had this sort of eccentric experience. Neither one of us left home. We both went to college in the city where we lived. We were very unimaginative, I guess, in certain ways. We both stayed living at home, and now and then our parents would say, "Do either of you ever plan to move out?" And we would just laugh and say, "Why would we? We're very happy here." And so eventually our parents moved out, and they left us together in their home. And we continued to live together for 2 more years.
You're
which
kidding.
Is a very odd, no, it was a very odd experience because I was in my mid-20s at that time and he was finishing college. And just to live with your brother and have your parents move away was very strange. And then when but we got used to it. And by the time he moved away, then I was really stricken. I missed him terribly. And, you know, then to live on in the house where you used to live with everybody, but now you're the only one left, it was kind of haunting. So I wrote him this poem. Do you want me to read it?
Yeah, I'd love for you to read it.
The Little Brother Poem. "I keep seeing your car in the streets, but it never turns at our corner. I keep finding little pieces of junk you saved, a packing box, a white rag, and stashed in the shed for future uses. Today I'm cleaning the house. I take your old camping jug, poke my finger through the rusted hole in the bottom, stack it on the trash, wondering if you'd yell at me, if you had other plans for it. Little brother, when you were born, I was glad. Believe this. There is much you never forgave me for, but I tell you now, I wanted you. It's true there are things I would change. Your face, bleeding, the day you followed me and I pushed you in front of a bicycle. For weeks, your eyes hard on me under the bandages. For years, you quoted me back to myself, mean things I'd said that I didn't remember. Last summer, you disappeared into the streets of Dallas at midnight on foot, crying, and I realized you're serious, some strange bruise you still carry under the skin. You're not little anymore. You passed me up and kept reminding me I'd stopped growing. We're different, always have been. You're Wall Street, and I'm the local fruit market. You're Pierre Cardin, and I'm a used bandana. That's fine. I'll take differences over things that match. If you were here today, we wouldn't say this. You'd be outside cranking up the lawnmower. I'd be in here answering mail. You'd pass through the house and say, "You're a big help." And I'd say, "Don't mention it." And the door would close. I think of the rest of our lives. You're on the edge of yours today. Long distance, I said, "Are you happy?" And your voice wasn't sure. It sounded small, younger. It sounded like the little brother I don't have anymore, the one who ran miniature trucks up my arms, telling me I was a highway, the one who believed me when I told him monkeys arrived in the night to kidnap boys with brown hair. I'm sorry for everything I did that hurt. It's a large order, I know, dumping out a whole drawer at once, fingering receipts and stubs, trying to put them back in some kind of shape so you'll be able to find everything later when you need it and you don't have so much time.
That's from Naomi Shihab Nye's very first book, Different Ways to Pray, and was included in her later edition of selected poems called Words Under the Words. This is New Letters on the Air. That's really wonderful. Did you send this to
thanks.
Him?
I mean, oh, yeah, yeah. I sent it to him right away before. You know, I didn't know how he'd feel about it, especially since it mentioned him crying. And the most shocking thing to me was he had it engraved in metal and put it on his wall. I mean, I've never had a poem engraved in metal in my entire life. There it goes to show how different we are. But he liked it. He accepted it. That was one that was so personal to him that I would have to pass it by him.
Do you have to do that with a lot of your personal poems? I mean, do you feel
Well, you know, I don't always. And I always tell my students, you don't have to show anything to anyone if you don't want to. You know, sometimes that's a big worry if you're writing family material or about real existing people. And, you know, we talk about ways you can mask it if you want to. So, you know, they wouldn't be able to identify that it was them exactly, or they wouldn't feel embarrassed or ever even be sure. But I also think there's a lot to be said for not masking it. And, you know, if they end up finding it or reading it, you have no idea what greater depth it might take you to in your relationship.
Naomi Shihab Nye, a chancellor with the Academy of American Poets since 2009. She talks about her books that deal with straddling cultures in her full interview for New Letters on the Air. This episode, called In the Beginning, finishes with insights from the late August Wilson, the Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright famous for the vivid characters he created in his cycle of 10 plays, each depicting a different decade of African-American life in the 20th century.
I think it's where you start from. In other words, if characterization is important to you and the play emanates out of the lives of the characters, then, you know, then you'll create good characters. If you're the playwright whose approach to the play is by plot, then you're going to have these strong plot points that proceed. There are plot points in my play, but they're difficult to find because they're not in neon.
They're not, you know, obvious.
They're not
at
highlighted,
all. Right.
You know, and they come out of the characters. And, you know, to me, it's just a matter of approach. I think any playwright who sits down and says, "I'm going to approach this work of art, you know, through the characters," or would be able to create characterization. I think another thing, I think one of the things that most beginning playwrights falter in is the idea that characters, everybody in life, everybody has a philosophy, and everyone expresses their philosophical idea. Everyone is so anxious all the time to tell other people what they think about the world and where, you know, where they stand on any philosophical point. I see people do this all day standing in a supermarket line. If you keep that in mind, then you'll just say, okay, what are the philosophical ideas that my characters are expressing? And so when you go see them, they're not like cardboard characters. Why? Because they're expressing philosophical ideas. Very often, some of the same ones that you as an audience member have, then you can identify with them. So, yeah, I like that guy. Why? Because he thinks like I do. You know?
That's so true. Well, so when you start on a play, do you actually hear the characters in your head first? Do you see the scene? What is the germination?
I have to be careful with this, because if I say I hear the voices, people think you actually hear them. Of course, I don't actually hear them, you know, but I imagine them talking and I hear the way they would talk. I work in what I call a black space, in that I don't see the set. I don't care about the set. I'm not interested in the set. You make a decision about where you're going to place these characters. But as their voices come to me, and as I imagine their voices, because they're surrounded by blackness. They're just voices in this space, you know, and they say these things and I write them down. At that particular point in time, I don't censor them. I let them say whatever they want to say because I don't know if it's going to be important or not to the play. You see, my process is finding the play. So I have people talking, and my job is to find the play out of what they say. As an example, so I'm writing piano lesson, and boy, Willie's like talking to Doka. He's, hey, Doka, you know Sutter fell in the well. Well, I don't know who Sutter is. That was a surprise to me. I didn't decide that Sutter was going to fall in the well. He said that, and I wrote it down. You know, and I didn't stop. I just kept going. I went back, and I said, oh, he said Sutter fell in the well. Who's Sutter? I didn't know. Now I got to find out who Sutter is. So in the process, other characters talking, and then he starts talking about Sutter. And then it comes out Sutter is the guy that used to own his family during slavery. I didn't know that at the time. I didn't know he fell in the well. And then how did Sutter fell in the well? Well, I don't sit down as the playwright and say, well, let's see, Sutter fell in the well. I ask the characters, hey, man, you know, remember you said Sutter fell in the well? How'd he fall in the well? He goes, well, see, you know, down around in them parts, and, you know, and he explained it to me. And, you know, I said, okay, I got that now. I know how Sutter fell in the well. And is this important for the audience to know? Yes, it is. Then you say, okay, who is going to reveal this to the audience? Which of the characters going to say that? And I go, well, since you the one brought it up, you know, you're the one that says it, you know. And he generally says, good. Now, what about that other stuff I said? I said, well, I ain't going to use that, you know. You know, it's a wonderful, it's just fun.
I was about to say fun was the word I was going to use. It sounds like you have a whole lot of fun in the creative process. So you just let it pour out there, and then later you go back and you reshape and figure out, like you said, I'm going to use the well part, but I'm not going to use the rest of what you have to say.
Yeah, well, you know, as I discover as I go along, I really work as a collagist, you know, and I'm a great admirer of Mayor Bearden, who works collage. So you just have little pieces and snatches of things, and your job is to assemble them into an artistic whole that has a certain aesthetic value to it. Other times I've likened it to having a pot as a metaphor, and you put things in your pot. You go, okay, a man with a scar on his face, a black cat, a garden. You know, and you throw all these things in your bicycle, you know, anything you want. It doesn't matter. You know, ideally, you should choose carefully, sort of, what you throw in your pot. But you throw all that in there, and, you know, you just go around collecting different things. And then you say, okay, what do I have? You take out your pot, and you say, well, I got a man with a scar on his face, a woman with a scar on her legs. I got a black cat. I got a garden. And you say, okay, now how can I use that? And then you start writing the play. And then the garden creeps up. You know, I garden a lot of my plays. I like gardens, things growing.
The late August Wilson, who grew his garden of poetry and plays, he completed the 10th and final play of his African-American cycle just before he died in October 2005. We hope his words, along with those of Tony Kushner, Richard Russo, Jane Smiley, Sherman Alexie, and Naomi Shihab Nye, will encourage your creativity in the new year. For links to the full interviews with today's featured writers, go to newletters.org and search for In the Beginning. There you can also sign up for our free weekly podcast or find us on iTunes. Follow us on Facebook, Tumblr, and Twitter at New Letters Radio. New Letters on the Air is a production of New Letters, the magazine of writing and art published by the University of Missouri, Kansas City, with partial funding from the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency. By the way, the annual New Letters Literary Awards are now open for new poems, stories, and essays. For more information, visit newletters.org. Today's show was originally produced with Alex Smith, Eric Motter, and Dennis Conroe. Thanks to Jamie Walsh, I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.